Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. On the national news scene, we hear lots of chatter about fake news and alternative facts. President Trump has called the news media the enemy of the people. And in fact, two news stories last week are getting a lot of scrutiny and rumination about their accuracy. A BuzzFeed report involving the president and a viral video interaction between teens and Native Americans attending different marches in Washington last week. So both negative statements by politicians about the media and potential mistakes by the media can cast doubt on journalism. But in fact, the role of journalism is protected by the First Amendment. Founding fathers believed the sovereignty rested with the people, not with the government. So James Madison and others crafted the Bill of Rights, and in the First Amendment specifically protected the right of a free press. They saw its role as holding elected and government officials accountable by reporting about their work as a way to enable the public to scrutinize and discuss it and ultimately cast informed votes about how the country is governed. It was seen as critical to a healthy democracy. So here we are in Anchorage, Alaska, a local and regional news scene. We may be far away from some of the national furor, but we are still a part of that information ecosystem aimed at holding government accountable on behalf of the public. With power comes responsibility. So who holds the media accountable? Is it just marketplace success, the most clicks and eyeballs and advertising? What roles do reporters and editors use to guide their work? Unless you work in a newsroom, you might not know. But we're fortunate to have two hardworking Alaska journalists here in the studio with us today. They both began their careers as reporters and eventually rose to leadership roles in their news organizations. So not only are they responsible for their own journalistic ethics, but they guide their teams in those values. So I want to welcome to Hometown Alaska, we've got Tracy Sabo, who is Director of News and Content at KTU Channel 2. Welcome, Tracy.
Thanks so much for having me.
Very happy to have you. And we have Dave Hewlin, who's editor of the Anchorage Daily News.
Hey, Kathleen.
Really, really happy to have you both. I know it's a holiday, and I know you're still putting out, you know, newscasts and newspapers. So thank you for taking the time to be here. And also, I wanted to say it's Martin Luther King Day, and let's remember that before we move on. So let's see. I want to tell our listeners that we're going to be talking about the Society for Professional Journalists Code of Ethics. We've got a copy of it on our website at alaskapublic.org. Each news organization often has their own code of ethics, but we're going to probably, maybe these editors will talk about their own. I know I went to Lori Townsend, who's the director of the newsroom here at Alaska Public Media. She provided me with our own code of ethics. It's 12 pages long. So I think it's good if we work off the sort of SPJ's code of ethics. But be sure there are rules that journalists are paying attention to. So one other thing I wanted to do was also just say, I worked at the Anchorage Daily News. I'm a journalist. I worked for the Nome Nugget. I got a journalism degree. I got hired at the Anchorage Daily News, worked there for a long time. David and I worked under the same roof, but really not together. And then I left
sometimes.
In 2008, sometimes
mm-hmm.
together. So, and here at Alaska Public Media, I'm a freelance show host. And so I fall under the same ethical guidelines, but I'm not really part of the newsroom at Alaska Public Media. So I just wanted to sort of talk a little bit about that. Okay. So I wanted to tell people just a tiny bit about your news organizations, and I'm going to do this quick, but I think it's kind of fun to know that you've been in our community like 50 years or so. So I'm going to start with Tracy. It's not your news organization, but you work
Correct.
There. So it goes back to 1953. It wasn't called KTUU. I got this off your website, so I think I've got it right. It was owned by some folks from San Diego. It got a broadcast license, Midnight Sun Broadcasting Company. Was eventually owned by the Lathrop Company and managed by Al Bramstedt. That's a name I certainly remember. By the way, I love that KFIA was meant to mean first in Anchorage.
Yep,
sort of
absolutely.
Pride of place.
Right.
So then, let's see, Midnight Sun invested in a new transmitter tower in 1955. KFIA became Kenai TV. In 59, Midnight Sun brought, oh boy, all these names are just too hard, but they sold Kenai to All Alaska Broadcasting, became Midnight Sun. This was a little detail I loved. On September 19th, 1966, Channel 2 became the first station in Alaska to transmit in color when it aired an episode of That Girl.
That's right. That's right. There's actually photos of that in our entry hallway. So it's a moment Moment in history.
It is a moment. The other thing I think about is the 64 earthquake and the people who were here who were watching some TV show that was, you know, delayed broadcast, you know, and everybody had the same experience. So anyway, I just enjoy that. And anyway, in 81, Bellevue Washington Company purchased Kenai TV. It became KTUU TV then. And in 2008, Schertz Communications of South Bend, Indiana purchased it, and it became Northern Lights Media. And then on February 15th in 2016, Gray Television of Atlanta, Georgia purchased KTUU TV. So,
that's a great recap. Much better than I could have done.
But I mean, it shows you the change in the media ownership, all those kinds of things that are some of the things happening in media today. And now I'm going to try to do the same thing for the Anchorage Daily News. And I honestly did not find this on your website. I found it on Wikipedia. So if it's not right, just bark at me, okay? The Anchorage Daily News was born as the weekly Anchorage News, publishing its first issue in January of 1946. The paper's founder and first publisher was Norman Brown. The paper became an afternoon daily in 48. In 64, it became a morning newspaper. The owners were nearing retirement, and Kay Fields moved to Anchorage in 1965. She became Kay Fanning. And she and her husband, Larry Fanning, eventually bought the Anchorage Daily News. And in 1967, and Larry Fanning died in 1971. Kay stepped into the managing and editing of the newspaper. McClatchy bought the paper in 1979. McClatchy's a company from California, and they've got a lot of newspapers.
National chain.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they still have Knight Ridder, but they bought Knight Ridder at some point after.
They consolidated the two chains.
Yeah. The Anchorage Daily News won Pulitzer Prizes for Public Service in 89 and 76. In 2017, ADN.com, I left out Alaska Dispatch, a web publication, bought the paper in 2014, renaming it Alaska Dispatch News. In 2017, ADN.com announced bankruptcy after being sued for back rent by GCI. Control of operations was assumed by a group of Alaskans that included Ryan Binkley and Jason Evans, and it is now owned and published by the Binkley Company. Any additions or corrections?
It was purchased by the Binkley Company, which continues to operate it.
Okay. So, again, lots of transition and transformation and impacts from new media and all kinds of stuff like that. Then, I'm doing the same thing for you guys, just a tiny bit about each one of you. Dave, I'm going to start with you. Dave Hewlin is editor of the Anchorage Daily News. He's a longtime editor at ADN and Alaska Dispatch News. As a reporter, he traveled extensively throughout Alaska. He was a writer on the Pulitzer Prize-winning People in Peril series and was among the first reporters on scene of the Exxon Valdez oil spill, a big news event in our state. And then Tracy came to KTU as news director in 2012. She came following 19 years with CNN in many roles, affiliate editor, radio anchor, domestic assignment editor, political planning editor, bureau assignment manager. Oh, boy. 19 years is a long time. She's been on teams that have won national awards, the Peabody Award for the 2010 Gulf oil spill, the 2008 presidential primary, and Hurricane Katrina in 2005. And she was in Alaska in 2008 covering former Governor Sarah Palin's run for VP. Was that your first venture in Alaska?
I had come on vacation prior and loved it. So any opportunity, even if it was to throw myself into political coverage, which is usually the last straw when it comes to network assignments.
Well, but Alaska politics.
Right. Okay.
So anyway, that's kind of the background here. But individually, I'd just like to go to you, Tracy. How did you get into journalism? Was it something like in seventh grade you had a newspaper at your elementary school? Or what was going on with you that journalism pulled you in?
You know, I wish I could say it was that poetic. It came down to, when I was in 10th grade, we did a bit of a survey to kind of look at what your skill set was and what you were interested in doing. And it came up incredibly high in communications. And when I went home to discuss that with my mom, she said, well, you know, you never stop asking questions. So I understand that. And kind of this persistent attitude, which I've been told since, we like to call it tenacious in the journalism field.
Right,
but,
right.
It was truly a thirst for information. But more importantly, I came to realize that it's a privilege, but it allowed me a front row to history. And I often say journalism is a place where you get to certainly meet people and talk to people and uncover and write to a great extent history in a way that you you certainly can't buy a ticket to. And so that comes certainly with great privilege. It comes with great responsibility. And it's something that from the day I got into it, that thirst and that quest kind of from information and to provide information has never really ceased. We joke in our newsroom a lot that the questions never stop. And, you know, other folks probably growing up that share the same traits, they were called nosy. They were called a lot of adjectives.
Busybody,
right? Why just let me be? But, you know, the reality is journalism is a profession where you don't stop asking questions. You know, even when it comes time to write, the questions generally are never 100% wrapped up. And that's the evolving nature of the business we're in. But I've never looked back because I found it to be a very rewarding position and one that I think the public, to a great extent, appreciates. But it's one also where I like to be held accountable and to that end.
Well, you know, sure I think it that. Takes confidence. I'll come back to that, you know. But Dave, let's talk a little bit about you. Did you grow up wanting to be a journalist? You went to journalism school at the University of Missouri, I think?
Indiana. Actually.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was a consumer of journalism first. I just enjoyed consuming it, and I was also super curious, and that's really kind of driven it. As long as I've been doing it, just curiosity about how things worked, and that, you know, and that kind of evolved into doing different things. I wonder if I could read something.
Oh yeah, please
do. I've been thinking about this a little bit. A few years ago, there was something called the Committee of Concerned Journalism. This was maybe 10 or 15 years ago, when there were a lot of these questions that you see today with all the discussion about fake news and so forth. And there was a group of journalists that got together and tried to just give some definition to some of this stuff. And that resulted in kind of a manifesto. It ended up in a book called The Elements of Journalism that you can find it on American Press Institute. Bill Kovach and Tom Rosenthal, editors, put this together. But they came up with a really pretty succinct definition of what is the purpose of journalism that I think just kind of nails it. And it's this. News is that part of communication that keeps us informed of the changing events, issues, and characters in the world outside. Though it may be interesting or even entertaining, the foremost value of news is as a utility to empower the informed. The purpose of journalism is thus to provide citizens with information they need to make the best possible decisions about their lives, their communities, their societies, and their governments. And, you know, I hope even that now that we could agree that there's value in that and, you know, and that's worth supporting, debating, you know, no matter what the platform as it continues to evolve.
Yeah. Okay. That's why we're having this show here today. It's simply, you know, I actually was moved to have the show because one of our hosts, a guest, brought a gift. As you know, and so much of life is relationships, and people are trying to have good relationships, but they did not realize that the host could not accept the gift. And then I thought, well, there's probably lots of people that don't really know how this works. There's many businesses that work on strong relationships. I would say news organizations also work on strong relationships, but it is at an arm's length. You know, it's not a cozy relationship. It is a, I guess it strive to be a respectful relationship. Tracy, do you have anything to add to what Dave said? It pretty much says it.
No, I think
what it did was it went beyond what I said in the intro, which is it was, you know, watchdog on government. It's also all kinds of things like financial literacy and how to raise your kids and, you know, I don't know, you know, dating columns. I mean, things that help people live their lives.
I would say, you know, one thing, though, I don't want lost is obviously our effort is to inform, and that is the large majority of what we do. That said, you know, journalism is also a way to shine a light in places that deserve that light, that aren't normally given that opportunity. It's also an opportunity to give the voice to people who don't have a voice generally on a larger platform. Mm-hmm. And so that's our role as journalists, to make sure that we are all inclusive, that we are not the person, to be honest, used to be. It was, we've collected the news for you today and we will deliver it at 5. Tune in.
Here's a snapshot of the world.
Correct. And the world is very different now. And I would say that has evolved to being a large portion of the journalism we tackle on a daily basis, is simply seeking out those whose story deserves to be told, as opposed to collecting facts and delivering, here's what happened today.
Right. Yeah. By the way, in case people just joined us and wonder who these voices are, this is Hometown Alaska, and we have David Hewlin, the editor of the Anchorage Daily News, and Tracy Sabo, who's the news director and news and contact director at KTUU, people who run newsrooms and actually have a statewide mission, which is pretty challenging. So that's we're talking about that today, and we're really kind of focusing in on what are the rules that guide journalists. If you're not a journalist, you might not have been exposed to the way the values or the guidelines that they strive to work under. And in the next segment, we are going to talk a little bit more specifically about what those rules are. But right now, I'm just going to sort of continue this little bit of background with our guys. I went on Friday evening to the Alaska Humanities Forum. They had a community conversation about journalism, and I thought, well, that's cool. I've got a show Monday. They're having a community conversation. Yeah. And it was very interesting. People were asked to give a word that journalism represents to them, and it was everything from, well, one print journalist said, it's print. That's all I can say. It's print. I'm old school. But trust was very important. I would say that was one of the words that came up. Constitutional came up. Public interest came up. Just a lot of things. But to your point, Tracy, that room was really filled with almost a certain demographic and even an economic demographic. Mm-hmm. And that brings me to a question about newsrooms and diversity and the attempt, like you said, we don't want to be the people rolling the truth downhill. We want to hear it, you know, we want people in our newsroom. So how is it going getting diverse people into your newsroom? Or do you even worry about that? Do you just try to get diverse voices represented in your newscast?
Both, to answer the question. I think it's always a concern if your newsroom is made up of one particular group of people, i.e. a background and a certain expertise, i.e. where they came from. You know, we really do seek that through hiring when we have those opportunities, but we also, you know, what we miss internally, and we will every day, if you're not a member of a community that represents a diverse interest in our newsroom, your story idea or your neighborhood focus may not be all inclusive. And so as managers and as part of the management team, we seek to constantly question that. You know, if a reporter might propose a story on a particular topic or idea, the management team as a whole and the entire newsroom as a whole every day has an opportunity to kind of steer that and say, well, have you thought about interviewing this person, or have you thought about reaching out to this group to ensure we have a number of voices and to ensure that it is a diverse story and that it's not my neighborhood thinks X, mm-hmm. or my friends, ethnic background.
Friends.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is a challenge, and in Alaska, it is a big challenge when it comes to hiring. We've had a great luck with diversity in our newsroom, but lately I've found it's a struggle, and I'm not sure why that is. There's nothing that separates us from being curious and being interested in journalism on its face. Mm-hmm. So why is that?
Why aren't people clamoring to get in your door from all
corners? That's what I'd like to know, right?
Hey, Dave, how about you? How's it working for you guys?
I agree with everything Tracy said. We deal with the same, you know, with the same issues. I think it's gotten a little tougher in some ways as all of our newsrooms have shrunk given the economic pressure. Those jobs are precious, and it's tough to reflect with fewer jobs all of the different segments of the community. And you really, I mean, one of the things that you know, that I always go for in this is we're really a mirror to the community, and and that means a lot of things, including reflecting the community in both who works there, but also the content every day, that it's actual, that it reflects some kind of reality and shared experience of the community.
That's a tall order.
It really
it's
is.
It's a very tall order.
And it's gotten more and more difficult to do, and there's also many different kinds of diversity. I mean, there's kind of what we would normally think of with, you know, normal demographics, racial, ethnic, and so forth. But there's also political. There's religious. There's
cultural.
You know,
cultural.
Mm-hmm. And it is a tall order.
Yeah. No, I'm empathetic. One last question before we take a break. You started out as reporters. You're now editors. Could you just reflect a little bit on the difference?
Well,
do you miss being a reporter, or
Tracy,
yeah,
I'm looking at you.
I don't
think you ever leave that behind. I mean, what we do in a different way from this side is still reporting, I'd like to think. Sure. But I will say the profession has changed in some ways. The speed at which it operates is a lot faster. I am very happy to say the ethics under which we operate, and I know we're going to talk more about that, have not changed. Mm-hmm. And if anything, I would argue they've been strengthened based on challenges they've been through. So that I'm happy about. But it's on a daily basis, you know, a journalist's true love is to always be touching a story and to be part of a story and be gathering those pieces. And while my role has changed on a daily basis, I don't think the DNA of being a reporter ever leaves. If you're an editor, if you're a news director, you're constantly checking and managing the work of those who are out in the field every day. And if anything, it gives you a different perspective. Mm-hmm. I feel like now looking at it a bit from the 20,000 foot view, you catch things and you hopefully hold the journalism accountable a little better mm-hmm. because you've been in the field.
Yeah, and you're a little bit distant from the story, maybe just a little more distant from the story. Dave, anything to add to that?
All of that, plus I find myself more, I think, an advocate for readers than I ever was as a reporter, where you're just really, it's kind of story to story or a specific topic. It's a broader mission to try to do all those things we've been talking about with a bunch of people and trying to help them. I'm succeeding if they're succeeding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, telling the story of the community.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a tiny break. I think I forgot to put our phone numbers out, so I promise when we come back from the break, I'll give you our phone numbers. You're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Fine, life going good, career on my mind. One day woke up, felt a bit queasy, really uneasy. My belly blew up and I just couldn't think. Is it acid reflux, a virus, a flu?
Oh, yeah. Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy, and we are lucky today to have David Hewlin from the Anchorage Daily News and Tracy Sable from KTUU Channel 2 News, and they both have important roles in their newsroom, and journalism is under scrutiny, and in fact, people are probably talking more about journalism than they have, you know, for decades, partly because it's getting a lot of attention nationally. We live in a very polarized environment, so it seems like people are in one camp or another. And here comes journalism trying to walk down the middle in many ways and give people the information they need to make their decisions in a democracy. So I would like to say, you know, if folks have questions about journalism or have had an experience with a local news outlet, give us a call at 550-8433. That's in Anchorage. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. But I promised we were going to talk about the rules that journalists live by, wake up thinking about, and go to bed at night worrying about. And I'm going to refer to the Society for Professional Journalists Code of Ethics. And just, I mean, there's a million points on this page. I'm not going through all of them, but I'm just going to sort of read a short sentence that is their preamble. Kind of builds on what Dave really read a moment ago. Members of the Society of Professional Journalists believe that public enlightenment is the forerunner of justice and the foundation of democracy. Ethical journalism strives to ensure the free exchange of information that is accurate, fair, and thorough. An ethical journalist acts with integrity. And then they've got, you know, four kind of rules to live by. I'm going to read those real quickly. Seek truth and report it. And they're talking there about the pressure to be accurate, to not be pressured by speed, to move too quickly before you really know what you're talking about, the pressure to provide context so that your audience might grasp the event very fully. Lots of open and civil exchange of views. So that's all under seek the truth and report it. The second big one is minimize harm. Ethical journalism treats sources, subjects, colleagues, and members of the public as human beings deserving of respect. And sometimes this can get into public figures versus private. People who've never been interviewed by a reporter may not understand exactly everything that's happening versus a public official who probably knows, based on their job or her job, exactly what this conversation is about. So it's about minimizing harm, showing compassion, recognizing that legal access to information differs from an ethical justification to publish or broadcast. Realize that private people have a greater right to control information about themselves than public figures do. Avoid pandering for lurid curiosity, even if others are doing it. Anyway, so that's some of that. The third one is to act independently. The highest and primary obligation of ethical journalism is to serve the public. And here we're talking about avoiding conflicts of interest. And that goes to that story I was telling about a guest coming on one of our shows, bringing a gift with them with all good intention, but that's something a journalist cannot accept. Denying favorable treatment. Be wary of sources offering information for favors or for money. I was just reading an article in British journalism. It was talking about it being damaged by paying sources. And I don't think that's anything I've seen here. I'm trying to think of the publication, the New York publication that might have paid people. Actually, to silence stories, but I don't think that your journalists, Tracy, do not pay for.
Strictly according to code of ethics, we would in no way, shape, or form pay for any type of news access, news interview, someone to actually fly in to tell their story. Anything along those lines would be prohibited, certainly under the ethical standards. The exception, if you want to call it that, is, you know, every once in a while, if someone someone captured exclusive video of something and that was the only place that video existed, there would be a vetting process for that. As a freelance photographer, we have a few of those that operate, let's say, after hours or in the middle of the night, and they often will catch scenes that others won't. We will pay for footage, and it's a very nominal amount, but we will pay for footage only from those we feel we've vetted, that we've trusted, and we will always label it as such so the audience can understand that this was not Channel 2 video, this was not video we captured, and we make it very obvious that it was captured by an outside photographer. That's no different than, let's say, a member of the audience or a viewer submitting something they saw as well. We generally don't pay for those either, and there are rare exceptions. You know, again, if it's exclusive video, but that's become a real serious issue under copyright, with more and more crackdowns in copyright, and we always want to be compliant in that way. So to some extent, a copyright agreement that involves a nominal fee will be part of that agreement. But I can maybe count on one hand the amount of times it's happened in the last, 6 months. Mm-hmm. So it is, it's rare, but it does happen. But the journalism portion of it, i.e. the facts, the information we gather on our own, mm-hmm. It may be that the video is from outside. At
times. And you have that pressure to have that visual part of the story if you can get it.
At times. We'll pass on it a lot. You know, if there's nothing unique about it, let's say it was a crime scene that generally shows cop cars. You know, it's not something the audience absolutely needs to see. Mm-hmm. From the journalism side of things, it would be better to just tell that story with the information on the mm-hmm. screen. But if there's something unique captured, it might be worth it.
Yeah, I can see that. And with everybody's with their iPhone, and I mean, you know, do you end up looking at a lot of footage? I mean, do people think, oh my gosh, I got something really great?
They do. You know, I would say it's not a huge amount that we receive, but we do. You know, like for example, when the recent earthquake happened, there was a lot of footage submitted. Every single one of those had a really interesting personal story, and maybe their house shaking or something they experienced, cracks in their driveway, and all of them were interesting. Very few were ultimately used. And each one that was used, we contacted them. We never would put that to air without vetting it. We would contact them. We would reach out for an interview. We would talk to them. We might even go to their house to confirm it. And I can tell you, I mean, none of those would have been paid access. That was simply people who wanted to share their story. Yeah.
How about you, Dave? How does it work in your newsroom?
We don't pay for news. We don't pay sources. Have really rules about, you know, taking anything that could be construed as a gift, any kind of gratuity, just to maintain that independence. Mm-hmm. I think probably a similar situation to Tracy's, a little different because we don't use that quantity of video, but we have probably paid for a video clip that would be in the realm of a freelance submission, mm-hmm. but as a rule, absolutely not.
I'm going to welcome a caller onto Hometown Alaska, and I know this person is from Anchorage, but they did not give us their name. But their question is: chosen topics can equal bias. Welcome. How are you there?
I am. How are you?
I'm fine. You want to flesh that out a little bit for me?
Yes, I certainly would. I really appreciate the guests, and I'm enjoying the show. I have a question that might be a little bit subtle or esoteric or off the wall, but so at the risk of that, I'm neither a physicist nor a journalist, but what I hear sometimes reminds me of what I understand to be a principle in physics, at least in quantum physics, talking about a phenomenon cannot be observed without it being altered by the observer. So if there's a general metaphor there between physics and journalism, my question is, and I'd be interested in hearing your guests noodling and talking about a little bit, but the topics that you choose to cover in and of themselves may slant the objectivity or the unbiasedness of journalism, it seems to me. And as I think about that, I'd love to hear their comments.
It's a thoughtful question, and I just before I go to, they're both shaking their heads and they're ready to jump in. But were you shy about your name? I mean, I guess I usually only get first names anyway. But what?
Okay, my name's Joel.
Joel. Okay. I mean, what was your fear? What was the fear about of using your name?
Oh, I don't have a fear. I just generally prefer to remain anonymous.
Okay. Okay. Understood. Anyway, I'm going to, who wants to jump in first? I mean, this is how you affect, how the reporter might affect the story by just being there and starting to cover it.
Joel, I'm happy to noodle on that subject for a second. But I think you point taken, I think you get to the heart of it, that in some ways the most important decisions that we make every day is not only what to cover, but what we don't cover, and then how those stories are framed. And I think we could probably sit here all day and have that conversation about the choices involved in that, you know, questions of fairness, balance, variety, just all of those. You know, all of those decisions we make every day.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Tracy?
Yeah, Joel, I truly appreciate the analogy because that was very well put. It's a concern every day. And to David's point, what we choose to cover does have an impact on, to his point, what doesn't get covered. You know, as I tell young journalists who come in and say, what do you want me to do in regards to a certain story or a certain decision? You know, there is no manual that comes with journalism short of ethics. And so there is much left to interpretation. And what I tell journalists in that case when they're looking for hard answers is, get more interviews. Go out and talk to more people. You know, if you're interested in a certain subject, instead of diving in feet first, and often time constraints do put a stress on that, but go out and talk to as many people as you can about that topic. If you come back and ultimately decide there isn't a story there, or that your story's not ready because you feel it doesn't have certain perspectives included, and it would be stronger for waiting, then you wait. We do that with investigative daily. I can't tell you. I mean, I think I did three of those last week where we put things on hold because I felt, you know, the story topic was a very interesting one. It was a very smart approach, but I wanted to hear from more people, whether they made it into the ultimate story or not. And so, you know, there is no list of topics. I often compare the viewer to the journalist, and the code of ethics as the third stool, you know, the third leg of the stool, because our viewers do hold us accountable. To your point, if we put a story on the air you feel wasn't vetted or wasn't inclusive, we'll often quickly hear from people who want to add certain perspective or want to argue that the topic wasn't a smart one or could have been better. And we count on that.
Or you missed this piece of that story.
Absolutely. Or was it, you know, God forbid, inaccurate. We like to say those are few and far between. At least you hope so. We're human like all. But I appreciate the story because it is one of those burdens that those are the things that keep us awake at night when it comes to, I can speak for myself as news director, did we do a good job on that story? Was that the right story to represent the debate or the community? And the good news in our field or our passion for a career field is that there's no dearth of stories. I mean, there's a story everywhere you look. How you cover it and what you cover, we have limited amount of people, but we want to do them all. So therein lies the conundrum.
Yeah.
And I just jump in, want to add, I think of this as an endless process that none of these stories are the end. And, you know, and the way we're doing this online now, you know, we can post a story in the morning. We add to it. It changes in the afternoon. It may be something different altogether by the time it's in print the next day. If there's more to do on that story, we'll do another one tomorrow.
Yeah.
And in some ways, we have more options than ever to be able to do that.
It's almost like it never stops, right?
Yeah.
But I'm going to welcome another caller onto Hometown Alaska. Hi, Bill. I see you are from Anchorage, and press outlets trying to suppress images. What are you discussing
okay,
there, Bill?
This actually happened, and thank you for doing your job, and thank you. Point is, a couple years ago, there was a presidential campaign. I'm not going to mention any names. A press outlet had a photograph that was used and enhanced by the artist in the campaign. And then the press outlet ended up spending millions of dollars to suppress the use of that image in that campaign. I was just wondering, you know, when you talk about neutrality, what about when the press outlet itself becomes involved in that kind of way? What do you think?
Okay. So you think that somehow,
I'm just asking. I don't think anything. I'm just surprised that a press outlet could be involved politically to try to stop a presidential campaign candidate from using their image. That's just surprising to me.
Do either of you know exactly what he's talking about?
I don't.
Can you?
Shepard Fairey was using Obama's image, and then the AP ended up spending $17 million to suppress him from using that image. He sat down with the photographer, and they worked it out themselves.
I do remember reading this.
But in the meantime, the AP made Shepard Fairey life a mess for about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. No comment?
I just don't know anything about that situation.
Yeah, I'm not as up to speed either. I mean,
not many people knew about that, but there was Well, thank you then.
I think, you know, what I will say about that, Bill, though, is, you know, copyright now more than ever and altering of images is, there are more watchdogs in that profession than probably any other as a growing form, and the courts are full of it. So I would say, you know, there's more liability on the part of all press to get that right, to not doctor an image. You know where you'll end up, and it's a very costly process and a very lengthy process. So I think, you know, whether that instance or many others brought more attention to that, as a journalist, I'm I'm glad that there's some resolution in that case, and that those who, you know, do seek to alter or defame the work of journalists by those type of alterations are held accountable.
Yeah.
And that's a basic. We don't alter images.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. I remember, with the arrival of Photoshop and what that the problems that could present if people could be sure that this was actually in the original photo.
Right.
We're going to take a little break, but we've got some interesting questions coming in by email. And we'll put out our phone numbers one more time. But you are listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I just want to put out our phone numbers for you. We're getting some interesting calls by email and over the phone. The number in Anchorage is 550-8433. Statewide, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we can also take your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. We have a couple of those coming in, and we're going to try to get to those. I wanted to ask a few more questions of Tracy Sabo, the news director at Channel 2, and David Hewlin, the editor at the Anchorage Daily News. Let's talk a little bit about mistakes, because I think I know from being in a newsroom that reporters nearly commit harakiri many times when they find out they've made a mistake. It's a very naked moment. You're out there in the whole world. Certainly people are calling you and telling you you made a mistake, but it's very important to correct those. And some people don't think the corrections actually equal the original damage done, if you want to say. And I bet, David and Tracy, you get calls from people all the time, and this is not a new question that you answer. But let's talk a little bit about mistakes. What do you tell a reader, David, and Tracy will get around to your viewers, when they feel really wronged by a mistake that your publication made?
We feel horrible when that happens. It's a human endeavor. And so it's a human activity, and we try to build a structure, guardrails, processes to get it right. But sometimes we don't. Sometimes, there are errors. And, above all, what guides us is to correct it immediately. And everybody understands that we've got processes in place whenever there's, the first sign that there's some trouble here. We try to figure out, okay, what was the error, correct it immediately on all the platforms. We try to be consistent about how and where we correct it. In print, they run in the same place every day. Online, on the stories, they're corrected immediately. They're in the same place. And we just try to have a process. And we have an internal process then when we make mistakes, where we do a postmortem and, go through a process. What was the mistake? How did it happen? How could it have been avoided?
Mm-hmm. And Tracy, something similar for you guys?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have a front-end process, obviously, beyond the journalist that's putting together the story, as I know David does as well, and the effort to go through and to question that journalist about the facts in their story to make sure their sources were vetted, to make sure they have multiple sources. But yes, when we are human, and you hope that your work is perfect the first time. I mean, there is no substitute for accuracy, period. And, you know, as the SBJ Code of Ethics outlines, you know, neither speed nor format excuse any inaccuracies. And so we have to take the responsibility for that. And we do on air in both the form of a correction. We'll also update our digital copy if it's online or it's on one of our social media platforms. And we hope they're very infrequent. I do feel that the public does an excellent job of when something is inaccurate, they will hold us accountable, and they should. We rely on that plus our internal system. Mm-hmm. But they're really, you cannot be too cautious. And that is one of the things I do believe that sets journalists apart from perhaps a lot of other writers out there that aren't held to the same standard on the same higher stage. And I only say higher stage because we have a very large reach. And the more people you reach, the more there are there to hold you accountable. And that's a good thing. That's the way journalism is supposed to work.
I'm going to go to one of our email questions. It comes from James Coleman. He says, journalism is like politics and the criminal justice system. It is very biased, he states as a fact. How do you distinguish between liberal or conservative, quote unquote, journalist when one is listening to them speak or read their reports? Okay, so, you know, this goes right to the heart of the sort of the national debate that you that there's an agenda behind stories. You know, there's a lot written about media literacy and people. I think you guys would both encourage your listeners and your readers to be skeptical of information wherever they find it, whether it's in your publication or not. But, you know, I'm sure you do get charges of, I know when I worked at the Daily News, it was the liberal rag and all kinds of communist liberal rag and things like that. How do you respond, David, to those people who suspect that you have a bias in the coverage or even in the selection of the stories?
Sure. When that comes up, and it comes up with me in the context of the national politics just so much more often than it does locally.
And of course, you cover national, you cover
that
stuff.
Well, we do to some extent, yeah. But when it comes up local, the first thing I want to know is what exactly do you see as the problem here? You know, and if it's somebody on the phone, email, whatever, we'll go through it. And, you know, the first thing is to try to understand what exactly is the problem. And I'll try to make a judgment. I'll try to understand the complaint and then try to make a judgment. Is that right? And I'm looking for fairness. I'm looking for completeness of, you know, sometimes there are two sides to a story.
Sometimes there's six sides
to a story. Yeah, exactly. And does the piece somehow get at that? Is it accurate or the different sides represented somehow? And then just try to come to a conclusion about that. And occasionally, my answer is, point taken. I understand why you might think that. Mm-hmm. Or on rare occasion, yeah, you're right. That headline really isn't right. I think it requires having an open mind on that.
It's hard because, I mean, you might naturally be defensive. You're taking complaints is hard. Does your blood pressure go up when you pick up the phone?
Not really.
I
hope not at this point because this really has to be a two-way conversation. Uh-huh. I enjoy talking to readers. And I'd like to think that most of those conversations, when they start out heated, by the time we're done, you know, we're having a rational conversation. But it does require not being super defensive.
That's a skill that all editors have to learn, probably, and reporters too. Yeah.
But the world we're living in now, this stuff is very polarized, and you know there's also lots of ways to do this. And in some cases, it's you know, and I don't know about Tracy. I think increasingly we're under fire from all sides. Not just the right. The left as well. People who are expecting kind of some confirmation in the coverage that it really conforms to what they think and believe. And that's become difficult the more heated these conversations get.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Tracy? Anything to add to that?
I feel very similar. It's the one thing that's changed and increased a great deal as we hear a lot more comments and a lot more callers and emails that we get regarding political coverage more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And to your point of they are seeking in many cases affirmation. What I often, I have similar conversations almost word for word. But what I often like to leave the caller or the person I'm corresponding with a thought that, fair, we always try to be fair and we always try to make sure both sides are represented. And I would offer them the exact same if it was a story that they were involved in. And just because they don't like the other side's opinion doesn't make that opinion worth sharing for the public debate. We've talked previous to the start of the show here for a few minutes in the studio, and we're better for having these conversations. That is what journalism is about. There are often not right answers. Sometimes there are right answers. Facts are generally facts. But even those we found have been a public debate, right? So, mm-hmm. To have the public discourse about these, to debate it out, but ideally civilly, and to respect the work of others, the opinion of others, to allow the reader to read in or the opinion column, I hope that doesn't make for a divisive climate or contribute further. We have enough struggles as it is, but I think it's important, and I think the tone we take as journalists in trying to tamp down that rhetoric to some extent and allow that public discourse in a civil way is really what we're all striving for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I imagine that your careers have been long enough that you might have a perspective on how the audience has changed. When I was sitting at the Humanities Forum listening to the discussion about journalism, I began to think about the audience and how's the audience doing. And they're getting pulled in many, many directions. Nice. And I wonder, David, in your career, it's been 20, 25 years, something like that, do you think the audience, you pick up a change in the audience? I don't know. Or maybe they've always felt like, you didn't tell my side of the story,
It's changed tremendously. The internet has changed everything. That people have access to so much different kinds of information on all different platforms. Mm-hmm. That's the big one. And just access to a lot of information. And in some ways, the ability to hold us accountable in a way maybe that they weren't in the past, just because they have exposure, they have the ability to access a lot of information now.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. And I mean, when I think about how is journalism doing, I actually think that there's more information out there. I mean, think about the people who are into podcasts. They're into news podcasts and health podcasts. Now, not necessarily journalism, maybe always, but it is information. And it's like, I remember a book, Information Overload, a couple of years ago about just, too much information. I'm going to just try to get to Tom McCrane's question here. I don't know if we have an answer for him, but we were talking about ethics, and this question was about covering the desperately poor or sick. How ethical is it that everyone else, the reporter, the producer, the editor, the host, the advertisers, profit, but no help is given to the subject of the story? I appreciate the slippery slope problem, but maybe the reporter and everyone else should be working for free in those instances. I don't know. This gets to the business model of journalism to some degree. It has to pay its bills. But I think, Tracy, over the break I read this to you, and you was like, well, we don't get paid by the story.
Yeah, we're certainly not paid by story, and I will hopefully dispel any myth that, for the most part, journalists are at the top end of the upper echelon when it comes to salaries. Certainly the business has changed quite a bit, and it's a for-profit business. Alaska Public Media obviously is not, but in my case it is, and in David's case it is. I assure you the journalists are doing the work they've always done, and it is rewarding to us as journalists, not financially, but through a sense of why we've gotten into this business, to cover stories about the underserved or the underprivileged. And I do think the attention alone does help. I think whether it causes more attention for the issue. We've often heard back after stories we've done about someone who was struggling, be it financially or through other ways, that people have risen to help. And that's a wonderful thing to hear back. I do feel like that's our role to a great extent, although financially we don't certainly pay them. I think that would cross the line of ethics we've discussed earlier. But I appreciate the sentiment, because I think we all got into this business to try to inform, to try to help, albeit in a different way, by calling attention into the plight of others or those underserved or places mm-hmm. where a light needs to be shined because right. attention needs to be paid.
Right, right. Dave, anything to add there?
No, our thing really, it's not to help people financially. I think my point of view would be our job is to put the information out there and the community, the community can do its thing, mm-hmm. but that's really not our place.
You know, at this journalism forum, there was somebody said, well, the role of journalism is to unite a community. And I was thinking about that, and I thought there's ways that journalism does bring out compassion for other people, the sort of thing you're talking about, Tracy, where people realize something's wrong and they rise to the occasion, and the story is actually what made that happen. But one journalist there said, this is not the role of journalism to unite a community. That is not it might happen, but it is not the role. And, you know, I don't know, do you have anything to say about that? Dave, you're kind of shaking your head. Yeah.
Well, I would think our role is more to provide a baseline of facts that a community could use to have a conversation. That I can get on board with that much more than I think it's difficult and really not our place to unite a community. We can maybe provide some common ground for a community to have, you know, to have a conversation, to, you know, to move it closer to a solution to a tough problem by facilitating a conversation or providing information. But, you know, I'm not sure how that would happen or how that would work for us to actually unite a community
on our own. I know it's hard. I mean, sometimes when I think about news, I think, well, I remember my daughter's elementary school teacher saying, I can't read the newspaper anymore. It's just got so much bad news in it. and I thought, well, bad news has a certain effect on us. I mean, it's like it's almost biological. It's like, oh, I need to know this. This might, you know, matter. But in a community, any given day, a lot of other things happen that are not those news stories. But, you know, that's not news, you know.
Well, and I would say our mission statement at Channel 2, it's on the wall when you walk in the building. It's to tell Alaska's story. You know, that's very broad and kind of it doesn't get to the heart of what we do every day, which is to obviously inform. It's to hold the powerful accountable. To that point, sometimes we actually serve as a polarizing we serve that role in our community by holding the powerful accountable. Some people don't like what we do every day. Certainly, if we're doing an investigative story of wrongdoing, my suspicion is you wouldn't like our work. Mm-hmm. But having said that, it's an important role, and if it unites at times, if it divides at times, it's a much more important role, as you started out the show and saying mm-hmm. at the top, it's one of the Constitution that protects information and freedoms.
Yeah. One other, I know we're running down, I've got a caller here, but I'm going to ask this question before I take the call, which is, everybody's a journalist today in a way. There are bloggers, there are videographers, there's everybody out there. And, you know, sometimes organizations may feel like, well, they're not journalists, you're journalists, you've got credentials maybe. You know, how do you see that? Do you see that as enriching the information environment around you? I mean, Alaska has lots of bloggers that are doing some political stuff, some cultural stuff, all kinds of stuff. Do you feel like you're the journalist and they're not? Or what do you think about that?
I personally think more voices the better generally. I think mm-hmm. that's a good development. The technology has really has given access to these tools to a lot of people. I think anybody can be a journalist in a sense. Anybody with a phone who records a situation, that can be journalism. That doesn't mean everyone with a phone is a journalist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it gives them the tool to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's no question in my mind, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. Tracy,
I just encourage everyone, read more, watch more, but vet your sources. I mean, to your point, everybody can be a journalist, but not all operate by the same ethics, same standards, and I would hope they do. But as a reader, as a viewer, do your part. That's important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I am just going to, we only have a couple minutes left. Caroline, you have questions about pressure on owners and management. Go ahead and give us just a quick sentence on that.
Yeah, my experience was September of 78 through mid-May of 79, so things, of course, have changed. And I was want to congratulate you folks. You're doing a job that a judge has to do. You can't advocate for one or the other side. You have to sit there and make sure you're being fair all around. But, and this
Caroline,
question doesn't go to modern day, but it has to go if in the past you had a management that wanted to tell you to chase ambulances or whatever you should cover.
Okay, Caroline, I don't know if you can hear it, but the music is running down our necks. So I have to say, we're out of time. Thanks for calling, Caroline. And I want to thank Tracy Sabo and David Hewlin for coming on, and also our listeners and callers. I'll be back as your host next Monday on Hometown Alaska when we sit down with members of the Anchorage Opera and learn how opera is relevant in modern times. They've got a new opera coming up, An American Dream. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Chris Badalek, our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.